Ellen Gilmore, our astronomer, joining us once again from Mount John, the observatory above Lake Tekapo in the Mackenzie country. Kia ora, Ellen. Ellen, thanks for joining us again.
Kia ora, Brian.
Aurora. Now, I remember you and I talking about solar minimum and how this must have been at least 5, maybe 10 years ago now. And there was research which had been, scanning the sun in beyond the surface, deeper into the sun, below the surface, to get some sense of solar minimum and maximum. And based on that research, they were predicting the next minimum would be a particularly minimal one, and we get less in the way of night sky action, northern and southern lights. Does that ring a bell with you? Do you remember that, us discussing that, Alan?
Yeah, I think so. That would have been the GONG, what they call the GONG experiment. I've forgotten what GONG stands for, but it's a telescope in Antarctica, which during the southern summer just tracks the sun all the time through the 24 hours the sun is up. And it can identify pulsations like sound waves going through the sun, and a bit like earthquakes going through the earth. And from that, they can construct quite detailed maps of what's happening in below the sun's surface. And I think it was probably based on that the prediction came out that they weren't seeing a build-up of the magnetic wind-up that happens to cause sunspots, and they were expecting it to be a pretty low solar maximum when it happened.
And were they right?
Yeah, the last two solar maxima have been quite low. In fact, there's even been suggestions that the sun might be entering what is called a Maunder minimum, named after E.W. Maunder, who was a British astronomer back in the 19th century, who pointed out that there was a long gap between 1648 and 1715 of almost no sunspots at all. And from other evidence, we know that the sun spends about a fifth of its time in one of these long extended minima. And the last two, that's the last 20 years or so, two solar cycles, have indeed been quite low.
But this research, now it's not based on scanning or trying to assess what's going on inside the sun. It's more about patterns and predicting something based on patterns, right, in terms of maybe the next us coming heading into a period of more aurora action?
Yeah, it's from papers produced by a team at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research, and they quite clearly state that they are heretics as far as the sort of theory of what's going on inside the sun that produces sunspots. They've been working for quite a while and published several papers on an idea that there are in fact kind of two 22-year cycles going on with the magnetic fields inside the sun, and that these two sort of cycles interact to produce the 11-year cycle that we see. And what they find when they go back through about 200 years of sunspot data is that, and it comes out from their theory as well, that if you get a short cycle of sunspots, and the average is 11 years, but it varies from about 8 to about 15, I think. If you get a short cycle of sunspots, then the next cycle will be much more intense, much more active. And so the consensus has been that the sunspot cycle just starting is also going to be a low one, like the last two have been. What they're saying is that this last sunspot cycle was unusually short, and so they're predicting that the coming sunspot cycle over the coming 11 years will in fact be a very active sunspot cycle. This is great science because it's immediately testable. I mean, immediately in the sense of the next few years. So if they're right, and as I say, the consensus doesn't agree with them, then we could see a lot more sunspots and hence a lot more aurora, as you noted.
When's the next solar maximum due?
Oh, I don't know off the top of my head, but roughly 5 years' time. And the maximum of aurora tends to follow the sunspot maximum by about 2 years. So we're looking sort of in the next 5 to 7 years, I think, for great auroral activity if it happens.
We're dealing with conflicting ideas then, and we'll know at the end of this decade
We will. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But up till this was published, these ideas were published. Was the evidence supporting the idea that maybe the sun was going into a period of lower activity?
Well, because the last two sunspot cycles have been very low in their activity, in their maximum, there was the suggestion. I don't think it was based on any sort of interior information as far as we can get it from the sun, but there was the suggestion that the coming one would be also a very low, would have very low activity.
Alan, you said the aurora activity tends to follow the sunspot maximum. It's not exactly the same time. Can you tell me first, what is a sunspot?
Well, a sunspot is where you've got magnetism breaking through the surface of the sun. The rotation of the sun winds up magnetic fields inside the sun, and these fields can pop through the surface of the sun, and where they do, the temperature at the surface of the sun is a bit lower. They look quite dark if you project them onto a screen. They look quite black, but in fact, if you could isolate one on its own, it would be quite brilliant, like an arc lamp sort of brightness. So they have a temperature, I think, of about 4,000 degrees, so they're not all that much cooler than the sun's surface. And what you get around these magnetic fields popping through is you can get build-up of energy in that magnetism. And if two sort of opposing magnetic fields come together, they can sort of collapse down, and all that energy is then sort of forced into the surface of the sun and produces what we call a solar flare, which is a kind of explosion on the surface of the sun where you get a brightening. And that can throw material off into space at high speed. And if that charged gas hits the Earth, it gets channeled by the Earth's magnetism. Well, it's quite complicated as to exactly what happens, but the end result is that a lot of charged particles get dumped into the north and south pole areas of the Earth, and they collide with the very thin air high up and cause it to glow, and that's what makes the aurora.
And that's why we get the aurora closer to the poles, unless it's a really, really big burst of solar particles coming our way. And sometimes aurora can be seen quite close, maybe even at the equator, but that's very rare.
Very rare. The classic event is what's called the Carrington event of 1859, which incidentally was just after the first solar flares were seen. Carrington was a British solar observer, and he was plotting sunspots. He was marking sunspots on a projection of an image of the sun, and he saw this brightening occur around the sunspot area. He saw, I think, on one day, and then the next day there was another one. And a day or so after that, there was this brilliant aurora that was seen pretty much all over the globe. I think they were seeing aurora as far south in the Americas as Cuba. And it produced all sorts of electrical effects on the ground because of the ground currents that these magnetic fields cause. Telegraph stations were getting enormous voltages coming through their telegraph wires. And in fact, I think one was actually set afire by the sparks coming out of the telegraph. If it happened today, it would be devastating because we've got power grids all over the globe, and they would be similarly affected. So, you can get really bad or really big auroral effects.
Planet number 9. Okay, Pluto's not a planet, and there's no chance of Pluto being renamed a planet, is there, Alan?
No, Pluto is about one-fifth the mass of the Moon. It's really tiny, but it was just the first of a whole lot of planets, asteroids, icy asteroids outside Neptune to be discovered when it was found in 1930.
What supports the idea that there is a much larger planet further out, much larger than us, maybe 5, maybe 10 times bigger than Earth in terms of mass, but way out from further out in the solar system? Why are people even thinking that's possible?
What happened was there are searches being made for very distant asteroids, icy asteroids, large ones, a long, long way out. And the first half dozen found, which were really distant, like distances of 250 to 1,000 times Earth's distance from the sun, they had a common characteristic in their orbits. It's a bit complicated, and I don't think I fully understand it, but the orbits were aligned in a particular way that could be explained by the gravity of a planet that was perhaps 5 to 10 times Earth's mass, orbiting a lot further out again. So this idea was proposed that there was a planet 9, as it's now called, replacing Pluto, at this very large distance. Now, it hasn't been found directly, but in the meantime, a lot more of these distant big objects have been found. I think you, for instance, talked to Michelle Bannister. Mm. She did one of the teams that found quite a number of more of these objects. And when you throw more of these into the mix, this apparent alignment of orbits just disappears. And it's just shown pretty much to be a chance effect.
Okay, so that's interesting, Alan. So basically we saw a few and we thought maybe we had a pattern. Now we see more and we see more noise and less pattern.
Exactly.
Right. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's the way science works. I can remember when quasars were first discovered way back in the 1960s, and the initial few quasars sort of fitted along what's called a great circle, kind of a circle around the whole sky, and this was thought to be very significant. But when more were found, that pattern just disappeared. Yep.
Blinking giant. I'm not sounding the NG very well here. Blinking giant found near the center of the galaxy. Now, I read this and I immediately was thinking of, and it took me a while for me to remember, Betelgeuse. We've spoken about Betelgeuse and how it sometimes fades, and there wasn't an idea that maybe that meant it was about to blow as a supernova. Is this star, which is fading, like Betelgeuse in any way?
Well, it's fading, but the fading is far, far more dramatic. The Betelgeuse case was has been explained thanks to detailed imaging. Because it's so big, there's certain technologies that we've got that can actually image the disk of the star, of Betelgeuse. And what appears to have happened is that it's a very big and cool star, and it threw off a cloud of gas that cooled down, and sort of sooty material forms in the cloud from carbon and such like things. And it did that and basically kind of disappeared. Well, it didn't disappear, but it got dimmed by a cloud of its own soot, essentially. But that was a dimming that it was pretty obvious to the eye, but it wasn't very dramatic. In this case, the one we're talking about, the star at the center of the Milky Way, or near the center, toward the center of the Milky Way, it's gone down by a factor of about 30, which means that it's pretty much disappeared. And it's a star that's been constant up till now. The suggestion is that it's being orbited by another star that has a large dust disk around it. And there have been one or two other stars in this kind of sort of setup that have been found. There was one quite dramatic one where the brightness of the star was flickering quite rapidly, but not sort of repeating. And that's been explained now by having if you think of sort of Saturn's rings, which are composed of rings with lots of gaps in them, the gaps are quite tiny. Well, imagine a giant version of that orbiting a star, and that star is in fact also going around another star, and the disk obscures the other star. So as it sort of crosses in front of the other star, you get this rapid flickering. I say rapid flickering over days or weeks.
And Alan, this star is called VVVWIT/08. Mm-hmm. How big is it?
They say it's 100 times larger than the Sun, which makes it a very typical giant star.
Okay.
Betelgeuse is something of that sort of size too.
Right. And now, isn't there at the centre of the Milky Way, we think there's a black hole?
Oh, yes, but that's greatly obscured from us. It's only using infrared telescopes and infrared technology that they've been able to image stars that are orbiting around that central black hole. And it's from those orbits that we know that the black hole is about 4 million times the mass of the Sun.
And how close is this star to the black hole, to the center?
I don't know, but it wouldn't be in the same direction because we just simply can't see stars like that in quite that direction, I think. But yeah, I to be honest, I haven't looked that up, and they don't say in their press release or whatever how close it would be, but I don't think it's likely to be at all close to that, to the black hole region.
Alan, in the final 2 minutes that we have, can I just ask you, now I'm right at home at night, and I'm pretty sure I can see two planets rising in the eastern sky, pretty high by the time I'm heading up the hill at midnight. I think one must be either Mars or Jupiter, because it seems to have a bit of a reddy tinge to it. The other one, I'm guessing, is Saturn. Am I right?
Yep. The brighter one, with the golden sort of tint, is Jupiter. And above it, at least above it in the evening, is Saturn, quite a bit fainter, but still a bright star. Saturn rises at about 9 o'clock now, more or less in the southeast. It's on its own in that area of sky. So if you see a brightish star in the southeast after 9 o'clock, that'll be Saturn. And then about an hour and a half later, Jupiter comes up, and Jupiter is much brighter again, and Jupiter becomes the brightest star in the sky till dawn. Earlier in the evening, you probably miss it because you'll be at work, but just after sunset, you can see Venus over in the west, just above where the sun went down, and Venus is also a brilliant planet that sets about an hour and a half after the sun.
Is it particularly bright at the moment, Alan?
Yes, it is, but it's kind of low in the twilight currently. It's swinging out from behind the sun, so it'll swing higher in the sky and be setting later. So by about July, toward the end of July, you'll have Venus on one side of the sky, in the west or toward the northwest, and you'll have Jupiter and Saturn in the southeast. So you'll have three bright planets sort of on opposite sides, well, one on one side and two on the other side of the evening sky.
Alan, it's been lovely speaking with you again. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Alan Gilmore, our astronomer, former superintendent of the Mount John Observatory above Lake Tekapo. He's still there, though, still doing his astronomy and still speaking with us. Back again in about 2.5 months from now.